As the cost of living keeps rolling on and it gets more expensive to live, to buy, to rent, to wake up of a morning, there's a common thing that's coming up all around capital cities in Australia, and that's high density residential living, so apartments and the like. And this leads to then the discussion, well, should I buy a one bedroom apartment or not? Because I want to own a property, I want it to be mine. There are new apartments coming online. They do have one bedders. Should I get a one bedroom apartment? Well, that's one of the things we're going to talk about today on the podcast. We'll also touch on some other fun stuff, such as solar panels. Should you clean them or not? Well, we'll talk about it. We can't do today's episode without Sphere Home Loans. Mortgage brokers always have your best interest in mind. The team at Sphere are covered by a best interest duty, which means by law, they have to act in your best interest. Just search Sphere Home Loans or click the link in the show notes if you want to chat to a mortgage broker about your mortgage needs. I'm joined today by John Pidgeon. John, welcome back to the show.
Pleasure.
Just on this mortgage broker thing, I recently got one of my properties valued because I'm doing some other stuff and I'm refinancing the property, right? Get this. And this is just an ad for mortgage brokers in general. And if you think that you don't need a mortgage broker and you've got an existing property, I'm sorry, you're wrong. You've got no idea. And I say that with all politeness because, get this, the first lender that they went to valued the property at $710,000, right?
Yep.
The second lender they went to valued the property at $775,000.
Yeah, wow, 65 uplift.
Yeah, so all this to say, it means nothing, quote unquote, because I'm not selling the property, but if I'm releasing equity out of that property, or if I had a bad home loan rate and I wanted to refi the property, more equity is more. More is more when it comes to money. So what if I went to Lender One direct, looked online and did all this stuff? Because the thing is with mortgages, and we should just start the podcast. We'll start it now and I'll finish my little rant about this. So my name's Glenn James. You're joined by John Pidgeon and this is Money.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So in finishing my little rant on when you've got a mortgage and you want to review the mortgage, a lot of the time, people just are led by the advertised interest rate, right? And the common argument, and this is no longer an ad for Sphere Home Loans, this is just an ad for, you know, the world. A lot of the time, John, people are like, I don't need a mortgage broker because I can do it myself online. I've looked at some lenders and looked at the interest rates, right?
Yep.
And often it'd be like, well, I'm going to this lender over here. They've got the best interest rate advertised, so I'll do that. Now, that's cute. And in practice, if you've got a really low LVR, which is a loan-to-value ratio, you've got as many options as you want, realistically, because there is less risk in the loan. If your property is worth $800,000 and you had a mortgage of $400,000, sure, knock yourself out. Go to any place. You'll get a really good rate. But the thing is, when it comes to most people most of the time, we don't have a 50-50 split between loan and value, right? You might have 75, you might have 80,000. So you can't be plucking the chicken based on rate alone first. And this is why if you're refinancing or wanting to release equity to buy a second property, the rate, I believe, is secondary because we want to get some options. So the broker, they gave me a couple of options. Hey, we're thinking about these two lenders. Yeah, the rates are kind of the same, but let's get some valuations and see. And then getting a valuation of the property, that's when you can really know what the bank thinks it's worth. And the broker even said, and because there is more equity now, you'll go into their next tier of a better rate anyway. So the fact that you know, you kind of look at rates, but you really need some valuation to see what they actually think the property's worth. Then you can actually know what you're dealing with.
I think you're right on the servicing thing. Like everyone looks at the rate, don't they? And they say, well, okay, I can get 6% versus 6.2%, so I'm going to this lender. When you're navigating through multiple loans for multiple properties, it's really about the structure and because the end result is, okay, I can go and buy a 600K property versus a 500K property. That's a game changer because it's either a better asset or it's in a better location or it's a larger piece of land or it's a house that's in better condition. That means I don't need to spend 30 grand on the reno, et cetera, et cetera. So it really is. And that difference that you mentioned before, Glenn, 65K difference in valuation, 80% of that's, what is that, 50 grand or something. So it's an extra 50 that you can play with. Now, will the banks lend you more money because you've got a higher valuation? No, but you've got more deposits to be able to play with to go and bring to the table. So it's ultra important.
And that's why this is so important if you want to release a parental guarantee. If you've got a higher rate and you paid LMI and there is meat in the property now, we'll review the mortgage and you might get a lower rate because the higher the risk, the higher the interest rate. And to banks, high LVR equals high risk. It's as simple as that. If you had a 0% LVR, it means you don't have a loan and you don't need a bank. So you got the best rate. You basically keep all the money that you were spending on that property, right? Yeah. So I don't know. I just wanted to kind of park on that and just talk about my own experience. And for me, John, part of the refi discussion was around features, and you mentioned features. And the broker said, well, there's an annual fee with this one, and this one you can have offset accounts and all that. And I said, well, to be honest, I don't need any offset accounts. These are just investment loans. I'm happy for it just to be one single mortgage with the money coming out of a different bank from my cash hub. So just looking at it that way, again, tweaks the ongoing cost because I don't have to pay for a package with, you know, all the bells and whistles.
Mm.
But it just speaks to why you absolutely need a mortgage broker.
Yeah. I've got a loan at the moment for an investment property that the online system is rubbish, to the point where I never actually even go on there.
Is it Virgin Money? Because I've got one as well and it's the worst system in the world.
No, it's not Virgin Money, but it sounds like it's equivalent. But yeah, it means nothing to me. We're not buying property or we're not getting a loan because of the lovely features that it's got on the website.
And that's what I mean. It's the worst experience I've ever used with an online bank, Virgin Money. But I've got a mortgage and I need to log in maybe once or twice a year, so I don't heaps care.
Yeah. Send me an email with my annual statement and
You can't even log in and see the interest rate online. It's just ridiculous.
Nor can you speak to anyone.
And I do understand the irony if we're running ads for Virgin Money, but there you go. Love you, everyone. Hey, let's have a look at some of these questions today that I want to discuss. Emmy said, hi, this is Money Crew. Looking for some sage advice again. About 8 months ago, I took a leap and changed careers. After about 18 years in my old industry, I've landed in an absolute gorgeous company with lovely people who I enjoy working with. But, dun dun dun, the work is so boring and unfulfilling. I'm torn. I think 8 months is a decent amount of time to have a good sense of whether it would be more interesting, but maybe I need to give it more time. On the other hand, I love the company. Anyone else had experience and what did you do? Like, what are you saying to Emmy in this scenario?
Yeah, it really depends on the personality, doesn't it? A lot of us go to work because we're stimulated, we're excited, we're challenged, we've got all these emotions running through that drive us through the day, through the week, through the year, and we maybe want to climb the corporate ladder or we just want to be fulfilled in our working hours for the week and come home and just feel content. It sounds as though Emmy's not feeling that at the moment. So there's no stimulation there. It's just simply, okay, nice people, great company. There's never any issues. I'm not stressed, but just totally not challenged. And I think it might be, it's like a bit of a sabbatical maybe for her. It's like, okay, if we started working at 18, she's been there 18 years, let's say she's 36. it's probably a time where you say, okay, this might be good for 12 months. Now the question is, what next? What do we really want? We know it's probably not this. Love you. It's not you, it's me. On with the next challenge. What do you think?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things here. It's a new industry completely, right? Which is awesome. Well done for taking a bit of a jump. The second thing, can you look at keeping in this same new industry, but a different role? As an example, if you were, I'll make something up wild. If you were a landscape gardener and you were doing that for, you know, those 18 years, and then you went and got a job because you thought you might get into some type of finance role, and you got a job in the clubs industry, clubs and pubs, and there was a big RSL. It's the biggest RSL in your area, and that, and you're in the office and you're doing accounts receivable and all that stuff, right? And you're just like, these are the loveliest people in the world. I love this. It's all good. But this is the most boring thing on the planet.
Yeah.
Now, from a boring and unfulfilling point of view, I think Emmy is now old enough to step back and say, life's too short to be doing stuff that's boring and unfulfilling.
Yeah.
So something has to change. But I would say it's not urgent. So now you have made the change to the new industry. Can you start, one, looking at your skills? Because it has been 8 months, so you will have found some new skills that have come out. So can you start really documenting and writing down what you do? Not what you do as the job, but what your actual skills are. And we talked about this last week with that career change episode. And then, can you look, even in the same company, at different roles? So you're in the club and you're in the back office with the most lovely people in the world, but data entry just ain't your vibe. Can you be like, hey, love working here, and say, look, can I be put out on the desk welcoming in new members? Or can I be out there on the gaming floor doing that type of stuff, so I'm working with people? So this will all be dependent on the type of industry and the type of company. But the winning thing here, Emmy, is that it's not urgent and you have changed. Okay. So what, 100%, make it a thing. Talk to as many other people. Think about, in this new industry, what you like doing. The best stories I hear are when people changed industries but kept in the same type niche. I interviewed someone last year on the Focus Friday episode. She was in HR and payroll and all that stuff. She moved to the IT industry and were doing some HRE things in the IT industry. Not necessarily like people management, but like back end of the app development stuff. So that's what I would say. You're in a great position. Thanks so much for listening. And we wish you all the best. Tom, this is a question for John. Hi, I'm looking at purchasing a one-bedroom apartment in a couple of years. Yes, I know I shouldn't be, but I need to live in the city for work. Brisbane units are quite expensive, and I calculated my future income with the bank's borrowing power calculator, and I'm getting concerned that I may be priced out soon. Out of curiosity, do you expect that a one-bedroom apartment in Brisbane will increase in price even further or stay the same? Sorry for the dumb question, but I'm just getting concerned about being priced out and may have to change my strategy. So lots there. And that's just an example, Tom. I love that you're thinking about this, but I'm not taking the bank's borrowing calculator from their website as gospel, because that's only one bank. And once you see a broker, you'll absolutely get a better idea of what you can borrow based on your situation. But this one bedroom apartment thing, John, what do you see as the opportunities and risks?
Well, I've got a bit to say about this. Let's hit it. He mentioned there that it's already expensive. I think we've got to ask ourselves, compared to what? All right. So is it expensive compared to what you're prepared to pay for something, Tom, or is it just is it expensive compared to the repayments, or is it expensive compared to a four-bedroom house, 10K out of the city, for example? Because I actually think they're quite cheap. You've got to look at a couple of, well, more than a couple of things when you're thinking about whether it's going to be a good decision or not. The first one is supply and demand. Now, at the moment, the Brisbane unit market has had an increase in the last 12 months. But if you look at the vacancy rates in those suburbs, for the last probably 2 years, they've been sitting at around 1% or below. So when that's when the vacancy rates are at 1%, it's extremely tight. There's hardly any supply. There's reasonable demand. And as a result, when people can't get something to rent, they're more likely to want to go and buy something in that same area. And investors can always get tenants, so the rents increase as a result of that. So it's a double whammy for tenants, but also owners. So if you reverse the truck back to 2016, 17, right through to 2021, you'd find in those sort of suburbs that the vacancy rates were up around 4%, and the power was with the tenant and not the landlord or the owner. So you could go and, as a new buyer, go and pick and choose what you wanted to buy and get yourself a discount on the way through. So with all that being said, that's with any asset right around the country, regardless of where it is. You just check those indicators amongst a whole heap of other things. But Tom, a one-bedroom apartment, we've got to think about, well, what do most people want to live in, either to rent or to own around the country in Australia for the last 100 years? And most people that buy property, Glenn, are couples that are either have kids or are going to have kids. Double that with the fact that post-COVID, we're now working from home more, so we require one extra bedroom as a result of that. So even if we weren't having kids, which a lot aren't, and that's fine, we still want that extra bedroom. Upsizers want extra bedrooms and space. Downsizers will still probably want minimum two bedrooms because they want one for themselves and maybe one for their family member to stay over, or again, a home office because they like to fiddle around with the laptop and whatever else. So with all that being said, the one bedroom is very applicable to a single person that wants their own privacy and no one else in the world, or a couple that's happy to just live their life, no kids, no space, for the next 20 or 30 years, right?
Yeah, or a couple that are maybe newly together, first place, they don't work from home, so they have to leave the apartment and maybe don't even have a pet.
Yeah, potentially. And then there's the other thing that comes into play with pets and whatever else. When we're looking at apartments in general, we're looking, obviously, at supply and demand I've spoken about. We're looking at size internal, how much room have we got with all the stuff that we own, and we look at the strata costs, what's the running cost per year, and how much say do I have around that when there's 120 in my complex and I'm just one of those. With all that being said, it's arguably the most least desirable type of dwelling that we could buy, because of those factors. And I don't think that's going to change. Does that mean that prices for that sector or that dwelling is not going to perform going forward? No, it's not. It just means that it'll continually play catch up and there'll be a ceiling as to how much someone's prepared to pay for it, because the demand will always be inferior to, say, a two-bedroom or a three-bedroom or a four-bedroom house or whatever that may be that's more applicable to more Australians.
Mm. But I think the overarching thing is, if you want to live within, you know, half an hour of a CBD in this country, realistically, property ownership is heading more towards, do you want to own an apartment or not?
Absolutely. Because of affordability.
Yeah.
Yeah. And something came across the desk today that said the gap between houses and unit prices around the country have never been wider. And that absolutely makes common sense. So there will be some unit growth, no doubt about that. There'll be an element of catch up, but it's always going to be inferior to the level of growth that we get from houses, for example. The one thing that a lot of people that I speak to don't factor in is, John, I've got 500 grand. I'm going to get myself a one-bedroom unit, and then in 5 years' time or 6 years' time, I'm going to upgrade to a two-bed or a three-bed. What's the issue with that? Well, the two or three-bed has performed superior to the one-bed in that time, so I'm still playing catch-up in 5 or 6 years' time, or I've got to have saved a good chunk of money to get myself into that two or three-bed. So we've got to be thinking, Tom, what do we want in 8 or 10 years' time, not in the next 8 to 10 days?
Mm. Yeah, and it does come back to the discussion with all properties, the difference between investment and to live in yourself. But I would always say, if you are buying it to live in yourself, can you get as many positives to future-proof that if your situation does change? Mm. And that might be, okay, I'll only buy a one-bedroom apartment if it comes with a car park. Like, just to, I don't know, you really just want to have as many options as possible. But the thing is, Tom, it works if it works. If the shoe fits, the shoe fits. John and I know someone a few years ago, they bought a one bedroom off the plan. At the time, they got a big cash back from the developer because the developer was kind of basically like, we've got to move this along. I think they got a $14,000 cash back for buying it. They got their first homeowner grant from the government. They didn't pay stamp duty. Like, the shoe just fit. And I think they lived in it for 18 months and sold it and pissed off. Like,
yeah.
So if you're doing a smash and grab, and they made money, because this off the plan stuff, generally, you know, there's probably at least 25 grand worth of commission in the property for the developer, so, and agents and whatnot. So if you do, like, if you can steal something, steal it. But yeah, I don't know, Tom. I would, my unsolicited advice to anyone who is looking at buying an apartment to live in, if you can't afford a two bedroom, you can't afford it to buy it, I think. Can we then say, well, I'm just going to rent an apartment? See, the good thing is, John, like, this apartment that I'm renting in Newcastle here, like, it's pretty, like, I know the owners live, I don't know the owners, but I know they live at Bella Vista in Sydney. They have had this as an investment property since it was built. Like, the chances of them ever moving in or kicking me out, like, I've got some good longevity here if I wanted it.
Yeah.
And I think with, you know, investment grade type apartments, you can have some certainty with the location thing. Sure, they could turn around and say, we want more money from rent, but you're going to get that anyway. So my advice to Tom would be, can you maybe do your wealth creation elsewhere and buy a freehold property, maybe in a regional area as an investment, and just keep renting in Brisbane?
Yeah, potentially. Like, I've just pulled one up here, some historical growth of a certain inner suburb of Brisbane. In 2013, the median unit price was $478. In fast forward to 2022, it was $495.
So it did nothing.
So 20 grand in 9 years, right? You're better off having it in a managed fund. So, yeah, will there be some growth in the coming years? Yeah, there may be an element of catch-up. But when you look at that historical growth, you've just got to question your decision. And the other thing on that is that units are made up of one-bedroom, two-bedroom, three-bedroom, studio. So that's just the median, right? So you've got to work into the weeds and say, well, which ones have underperformed. And generally, it's the smaller stuff that's sub 50 squares or 53 squares or 54 squares, etc. So treat with caution, Tom.
There is a question. I will answer it now because I had it on the list. Peter in the Facebook group, This Is Money, said, during a conversation with a broker about purchasing an apartment in Sydney, he mentioned that the suburb we were interested in is on the banking blacklist and banks are unwilling to lend in those areas. So there are some potential risks with one-bedroom apartments, John, and studios, where some lenders won't touch it because it is too small, and all the things that you've talked about means it's higher risk from a lender, because if you didn't pay and they had to sell it, they might not get their money back.
No.
Because there's less people that would want to buy it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I may have even commented in this.
Yeah, you probably did.
I think Rachel corrected me. I thought it was the actual suburb that from time to time lenders did blacklist, but I've seen it on numerous occasions where lenders have said, no, we're not giving out money in this particular development or this particular apartment block because we're already overexposed here. So, yeah, when you see those sort of comments from the lender, there's a little bit of a red sign there, isn't it? A little bit of a red flag, because you're thinking to yourself, well, if they're not prepared to go there and they've already got too much exposure, they must be a little bit cautious.
Mm. So, yeah. So basically, again, Peter, it does speak, you know, you're using a broker. I would imagine that broker could find a lender for that type of property. I mean, I don't think it would be a complete blacklist, but we know like some of those areas around Mascot and Alexandria in Sydney, it's high density apartments.
Very.
Like there would be some caution, and that's why you know, you just have to get your pre-approval on that property and whatnot before you start pulling the trigger.
And also a couple of things there, and Rachel would speak to it more than me, but one is if you go and buy a property that's currently tenanted and the rental amount is low according to market, the bank's going to lend you or calculate your servicing on that rental agreement. If that's $100 a week lower than what the market suggests and you've still got a rental appraisal from an agent saying, no, it's worth $100 a week more, they're still going to take that low amount. So take that into account if you're buying off an investor that hasn't put the rent up in 10 years. Mm. And the second part of that is you still may be able to lend in that area, but you may just need to come up with a 30% deposit, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, they might. The bank might just say, we'll do it, but not at 90% LVR. We'll do 85 or 80.
Hmm.
Ashley said, for International Women's Day, my workplace is having a guest speaker who is a certified money coach. What makes a person a certified money coach? Now, I just wanted to kind of touch on the whole money coaching thing and when it might be appropriate and when it might not. So if we go through, generally speaking, in the money world, there could be four types of people. There could be a financial counselor, there could be a money coach, there could be a licensed financial advisor, and there might be someone like John Pigeon, who's a property coach working in the Wild West, because property is not a regulated financial product. Property is no different than a set of steak knives, my friends. So there kind of are four professionals that work within this money world. So the first one being a financial counselor. These are people that are at the front line of financial stress for people. So someone who might have gone through bankruptcy, may become bankrupt and just in a real pickle, and they need to work through the consequences of their actions and a plan to get through that. And financial counselors, they are really dialed into, you know, the human psychology of it. It's basically like seeing a counselor. You know, a counselor is not a psychologist, and a psychologist isn't a counselor. And then one step further, a psychiatrist isn't them either. So there's always levels to everything. So a financial counselor, this is my situation. I need help to get out of here. And I kind of see the financial counseling thing as a frontline thing, might be used when there's been a natural disaster somewhere, and charities may wheel in a financial counselor to actually help people through a crisis and to get them on track. So really important role in the money ecosystem. When we talk about a money coach, now a money coach is not a licensed financial advisor or financial planner. They cannot give financial product advice. But what a money coach can do is sit down with you and help you identify potentially some mindset things about your money, potentially how you are spending and what plan you're putting in place to actually save more money and be better with your money. Literally an accountability buddy, if you will. I did actually message a money coach to say, oh, hey, can you jump on? and we'll insert it, you know, just after this little segment. She can explain it more. But a money coach can't say, hey, I think you need to take this savings and put into these investments. Like, they're just not doing it. They're literally coaching you with, you know, looking at your situation, challenging you. Like the coach that is walking past the swimming pool. They're seeing your money situation from a different angle and providing some commentary. And a money coach may be beneficial if you don't need structural financial advice. So you've got all your investments or you've got all your property, but you might want to get on the same page with your partner and you need a third party there to kind of bring you together. And there are a lot of ex-financial advisors who make really good money coaches because a lot of financial advisors have sat down with clients and got their goals on the same page.
So with all that being said, what's the steps to be a certified money coach?
Well, that's the thing. So I don't believe there's an AQF, which is the Australian Qualifications Framework, to be a money coach. But there is a certification that's come out of America. There's a company called the Money Coaching Institute, which was set up by Deborah Price. Now, this is one of the examples where it is starting to be a bit more of a thing. And look, does the certification actually mean anything? I don't know. I mean, if I said no, you know, Deborah Price and all the money coaches would probably, you know, come after me. But at least it's something, and at least there is a framework, and that's the advantage. Now, before you get outraged, not every product, not every service is for everyone. And we get that a lot of the times. Like, how many times we mention investment bonds and everyone has a meltdown? It's like, you don't have to use one. They're not for everyone. Like,
yeah. And what would you expect to pay for one, do you reckon?
Yeah, well, I think if we go back to financial counseling, there are a lot of charities that do that for free, right? Yep. We know for financial advice, you might be paying $4,000, $3,000 for a financial plan. But a money coach, you are sitting down with a person and it is individual and it is a spoke. So it could still be in the hundreds or into the early thousands, I would imagine. And again, these are just all different options. And then if we go down the financial advisor, they can actually sit down with you, look at formal financial products and make formal financial product recommendations. Yes, investing in this account. Yes, this is a good ETF. This is the super strategy that you need. This is the insurance strategy you need. Technically, with money coaches, if they did turn around and say, you need to get this banking structure, there may be an argument that that's general financial advice or personal advice because bank accounts are financial products. But I don't think it's a bad thing that Ashley's workplace is having a guest speaker called a certified money coach, because by going to a certified money coach and you felt that there was a need there, you will 100% get an outcome if you are the right candidate for that business. If I rocked up to a financial counselor tomorrow, there probably wouldn't be a great outcome for me because I don't need that type of service. So the fourth one, someone like John Pidgeon, talks about how do we achieve our goals of getting into a property because it's a non-financial product. And there will be some mindset stuff there. There might be some property selection training, really a third-party sounding board for your property goals. And I think that's the value with the money coach thing. It's having someone else in your corner who doesn't have a dog in the fight, who doesn't actually care if you spend $50 a week on coffee or $200 a week on coffee, but they can look in and say, that $200 a week on coffee, you got $100 a week left over after you've spent it all. Do you think that's like sound or good? I don't know. I just think if you engage in a service that is suited for you, you'll get results. Much like if you were suited for Pilates and engaged in Pilates, you would get results. And not everything is for everyone, so we need to have a cold shower about this stuff. But the best thing to do is look at testimonials from existing clients that have used these services, maybe Google reviews. Give the money coach a call if you want one. It could be a really good way into this whole financial literacy thing. So yeah, I'm not against money coaches. I know enough to be dangerous. And we're going to go to a break now. If I have managed to speak to someone who's a money coach before this episode goes live, you'll hear it right now. If not, too bad. We'll be back right after this.
I'm Karen Ely, a former financial advisor for over 16 years turned a certified money coach. So as a money coach, I focus on the psychology aspects of money. And that's really around what we think about money, our beliefs, how we feel about it, those common emotions that we experience when we're dealing with our money, which both of those things, our emotions and our thoughts, drive our behaviors. And our behaviors are financial habits, the good ones and the more challenging ones. So we all know that our behaviors create our financial results. I see this space as really our internal money management. So money coaching is a relatively emerging and new field in Australia, but it's been around for decades in the US, which is where I actually studied to do this work. And money coaching draws on the disciplines of psychology and neuroscience. And we use a lot of therapy-informed strategies in our work. So the types of people I work with is quite broad, people aged in their 20s to their late 40s. They might be professionals, business owners, single people or couples. But what they do all have in common is that they have some challenging aspects with their relationship with money and their habits. So it might be around that they spend more than they should be spending, or maybe they work too hard, or maybe they feel guilty about spending. So they're really good at saving, but don't actually enjoy money and have a lot of guilt around it. They might be quite anxious about taking action, and they kind of get into that overwhelm and stuck and do nothing. And we both know that we need to take action with our money rather than just sitting there avoiding it. So they're quite often the reasons why people come to me. Or they want to get control of their money. I hear that quite a lot. So if you're listening and not quite sure what your relationship with money is, I want you to think about this question. So if you thought about money like it was a person, someone you've known your entire life and you've had a relationship with it for a long, long time. So in a couple of words, describe what your friendship or relationship with money has been like. So if you just think and reflect on that for a minute. And Glenn, I've heard everything from money's a really loyal friend to me. We've had a really good, strong, trustworthy relationship. Or it could be something like, it's never there when I need it. Like money doesn't like me. It seems to like everyone else, but it doesn't like me. Or money's dangerous and scary. I actually worked with one client that when we went through and do the process that I take clients through, that she remembered that she'd swallowed a 20-cent coin when she was younger. And her mum responded like really, really badly around it. Like money's dangerous. Like, you know, you could really hurt yourself. It's dirty. And then she had a couple of other experiences that reinforce that belief around money's dangerous. And so as an adult, she had this ongoing belief around that, and she found it really hard to actually deal with money. So I worked with her to move through that. People have relationships around it being feeling controlling, or they don't care about it, or just money is just not a great thing. So they're the types of people that I typically work with. So what I do as a money coach is I focus on changing the behaviors, because changing those behaviors is going to lead to better financial outcomes. And I do this by showing them what they really deep down believe about money and about wealth. And most people are quite surprised. So the way that we are with money was formed between the ages of 2 and 12. So a lot of the work that I do with clients is going back to their childhood. What did they learn about money and perhaps need to unlearn? So some of the outcomes that typically clients get is that if they've come to me because they need to save more money and they're just compulsive spenders and can't stop, after working with me for a couple of months, they are able to save more money than they've ever saved before. Or perhaps it's around they've been in that avoidance and now they have the competence and competence to do that they've wanted to do for years. So quite often I work with people that they've had money sitting in the bank for years and wanting to purchase a property but just never done it. Or they've wanted to start share investing or know that they need to start investing but are too frightened or fearful to take action. When I work with couples, sometimes it's the results that they get is having more harmony in their relationship and diffusing those financial agreements that come up that can be quite challenging. So, you know, as a coach, It's just like working with any type of other coach when you work with a money coach. Sometimes you can get there on your own doing it by yourself, but by using a coach, it's just going to help you get there faster and more effectively.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com, click Get Help, and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Radio, we are back to the community segment of the week. It is brought to you by Sky Wealth. And that's another thing following on from this coaching thing. Sky Wealth, they're licensed financial advisors, but they only deal with life insurance and income insurance. So it's niche within that thing. So if you don't have your life insurance, please get it sorted. I know I've shared this just recently, literally just doing some money stuff with a widow whose husband passed away, young kid, no life insurance. I've seen the difference, peeps. The difference of 100% financial security versus going back to work within 3 months of the death of their spouse. I mean, it's just, and you, sure, there are some good social things with getting back to work and all that, but just the fact that to be in a 100% strong financial situation, it just gives you the option, whether it's time right away or not. So please, if you've got debt or dependents, make sure you get life insurance. You can reach skywealth.com.au and they'll walk you through the process there. John, we asked everyone, groceries are nuts. How are you trying to reduce your overall spend each week?
Or the cost of them, or just the nuts?
Groceries are nuts. Did I say it anyway?
Grocery costs are nuts.
Yeah, well, groceries are nuts.
Yes. Yeah, so cashews, too expensive.
Mm.
Zali says, plan my meals around similar food items, beans, veggies, etc. Then get home with the giant shop and order Uber Eats because I'm tired and couldn't possibly cook.
Far out. There's one way to financial ruin each week, and that's using Uber Eats and Menulog straight up.
Mm.
Jamie's going to try some fasting.
Amy says, Aldi, green grocer or Asian grocer for fruit and veg. Wasn't sure. I've never visited one too much. Green grocer and Asian grocer, they end up being cheaper than the big dogs.
I've no idea, but Amy reckons it is.
Amy does, yeah.
I mean, maybe it makes sense. I don't
know. Well, is it because you go in and there's only a select items to choose from, so you just grab those and you don't end up in the 17th aisle that you didn't intend to be?
What, like at Woolworths?
Yeah.
Well, I think more I'm only thinking that people know that they're going to Woolworths anyway, so they can probably just get a higher cost spread on the veggies anyway.
Yeah.
But this is funny. It's rare to – it's actually, yeah, interesting. It's rare to see standalone fruit shops these days.
It is. And I think they're making a return.
I hope so.
I hope so too.
Eileen – she's going to reduce her overcall spend by buying home brands. I shop online, so I sort by the best unit price on the Woolworths app, not falling for specials. That's good.
Yes.
Guess what? You've got to look at the unit price per 100 grams, per litre and all that. Forget the specials.
Yeah, I love that one. That's good. I am not. I'm finding a new dream.
Mm. Holly, shopping from my pantry first so I buy the bare minimum, meal planning based on what is on sale. But on sale, Holly, do you know that...
What is on sale?
Yeah.
They've marked it up and marked it down. Catherine says, eating at the in-laws more often. Love that one.
Mm. Actually, Catherine Mack, I've seen your name in the Facebook group for like a million years. I reckon you need to come on and do a money story yet. Let's get some of these names that I've seen that are regular pests in the Facebook group. Let's get them on for a chat.
I saw the biggest pest of all on another Facebook forum the other day. Oh, yeah. Commented on his comment.
Really?
Yes.
Are you going to name and shame?
Jaycini.
Ah, Jaycini. So Jay did a property podcast with Pidge on This Is Property a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, good yarn.
So remember John's book, Sort Your Property Out. It is on shelves right now. We've seen it at Big W, QBD, Dimex. You can get it online. It's so good. If you do want to buy it and you are a little bit wary of John, understood. I get it. If you go to sortyourpropertyout.com, you can download the first chapter, the full first chapter, free, no cost, and you can get a vibe for what the book's about. If you want to join us at one of the live events that are going on, we've already done Perth at the time of this recording. So Melbourne, Brisbane, Sydney, Adelaide, get on it. Come out and see us. They'll probably sell out the tickets because realistically we're not having more than 60 to 80 people at each event because we just want it small and intimate. So there you go. And this month, the book club, it is Sort Your Property Out with John Pidgeon. We're reading that this month. The book club.
Had a mate from Adelaide reach out to me today with a photo of the book. He's just purchased it in one of the good bookstores in Adelaide.
Awesome. How's it feel to have your book out there?
Oh, look, it's great.
Yeah.
I saw a reduced sign on it, so is that a bad sign?
No, it's like the whole marketing thing. Like the recommended retail price probably says $32 on the back of it, but you get it for $25.
Yeah.
Like it's everything. This is a lesson, everyone. This whole specials thing, like there's always this special for dishwasher tablets, right? It's half price.
Actually.
They're not actually ever worth the full price. It's ridiculous. It's marketing. The products are subsidizing the quote-unquote special, so it looks good on the shelf. I've got no more housekeeping. Did you have any other housekeeping?
It was a pleasure to sit alongside Shell's book. In QBD on the weekend.
Yeah.
Woolworths. What's the okay. other shop? Big W.
Okay, mate. Love it. All right, we'll bump out of this housekeeping segment and continue with a couple of other questions. We'll be back right after. Well, we're already back. Okay, Jasmine, long-time observer, first-time poster. Jasmine, thanks for your first post. I'm looking for advice from anyone with solar panels. How often do you pay for cleaning? I typically pay for an annual clean, but I've come across these cleaning meters from Solar Cleaning Meters. I think it's a company. And now I'm wondering if it's something worth investing in to extend the life of my panels and maybe reduce how often I have to get them cleaned. Keen to hear your thoughts. Do you have solar panels on your roof?
I do, yes.
And what did they tell you? Because yours is less than a year old.
Yeah, so every 12 months you need to have it cleaned for longevity.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't need to be any sooner is what I was informed with. But, it's definitely a no-brainer. You need to get them done like anything, I suppose. You need to keep it clean and so it runs efficiently, but especially with solar because, of course, depending on where you live too. Like if you're close to a coastal region, you get salt and crap all over it and it doesn't perform as well. So...
Yeah, because there was comments in the book, in the Facebook group and people were like, oh, I cleaned them. I didn't notice anything. Like you probably won't notice that much, but as a best practice, I would be cleaning at least yearly, once a year, probably even going into winter after summer.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be less direct light potentially for the day, so you want as much power as possible. And like anything, I'm talking with 100% confidence that I know what I'm talking about, but I don't. But I will say when I was renting up at Merriweather Heights, I jumped on the roof before one winter and got my hose and sponge and a bucket. I just use truck wash or something, whatever. Get your proper cleaner. And there were like there was bat poo, there was bird poo on them. And some of those poos can be like as big as this lens cover, like pretty big,
yes,
which is theoretically blocking out light, get rid of dust. So I will say you will clean crap off them.
Yeah.
I'll also say if you do want someone to get up there and clean it, I'm probably not going to a company that does dedicated solar cleaning, probably. I reckon a handyman service could probably handle it pretty well and probably a third of the price.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you work for a solar power cleaning company, you're probably outraged at the moment, but some cleaning from a handyman is better than no cleaning at all. But it can be dangerous up there. Like I was up there with the hose, suds and all that. I didn't have a tether on or anything like that. I was just going for it.
Yeah. Well, and most would too, but yeah, they say it ranges anywhere between like $200 to $400. So it's But in all that aside, solar panels, like valuers are valuing properties up now because they have got solar panels. So I think if you're looking as an investor, if you've got a two properties to choose from, one's got solar panels,
And it's interesting as well, and you're right, like depending on the location, the house I was at, it's kind of had solar panels on either side of the roof and one of them didn't get as much sunlight.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of rain. Like there was actually some mold starting to surface mold on them. So I just think you'd be crazy not to clean them once a year. And if you're going to choose that time, I would do it at the end of spring. That would be my 2 cents. Again, 100% confidence based on nothing other than my own BS.
Yeah.
What do we got here? Amy was wondering if lenders take into account income from a potential granny flat. Looking to borrow to build said granny flat. I wasn't sure how I would get rental appraisal for a granny flat. So we actually asked our resident mortgage broker specialist, Rach Croon. We didn't ask. She just filled it in on the Facebook group. She's the director and owner of Sphere Home Loans, the sponsor of this podcast, full disclosure. I'll get John to talk structurally about granny flats in a moment. But Rach said, your broker will guide you through this depending on the other requirements of your lending. Different banks have different policies. What? Who would have thought? Some will take a rental agreement. That's cool. Some will not use this rent if the valuer notes says that the granny flat is not council approved. Some will take bank deposits for those renting to family. Interesting. Some bank will take a projected income for the granny flat if you're building it, and some will not take this income until it's actually leased. You may have other lending requirements that the broker will take into account. What has your experience been with the old GFs? Gluten-free's.
Yeah, they've been very good. In New South Wales, must be 10 years ago or more, they approved, conceptually the New South Wales government approved granny flats as long as you met a certain criteria. I don't know, it was like 2 metres or a metre from the boundary, 4 metres from your home, all these sort of things, and then minimum size. So I know on the Central Coast there was a massive uplift of granny flat construction, and they were building them for like 70 to 100 grand and renting them out for 300, 350 a week. And that's still happening today, provided that you meet the regulations. And as Rach said, it needs to be council approved. But there, in other states, that might be a bit more of a rigmarole. If you meet the New South Wales government regulations, then it basically council approval it needs to be given essentially because of the state rules and regs. But I think it's a great additional income. Does it increase the value of the property? Arguably, it does somewhat because you've got a building structure that's there. Investors love it because of the cash flow. But what's happening now, Glenn, is the unaffordability of property around this damn country, Australia, mainly Sydney and Melbourne, is young Glenn and
Glennette.
Kids can't afford to buy their first home. So they say, well, okay, I can if mum and dad can help me out. Oh, right, we're ready to retire. Cool. We'll build a granny flat out the back. You live in the front. We'll live out in the granny flat and we'll live happily ever after. And then we've got on-site babysitters and all these sort of things. So it is becoming a lot more natural because of that. So homeowners are saying, yeah, let's put a granny flat out. And even if we've got a higher mortgage, and I know someone's done this just locally here, is they built a house and they've also built a studio out the back that has a separate entry just to pay the mortgage, Glenn, which is smart thinking. Like, you just think $300 a week, $15,000 a year, it's nothing to be sneezed at, and it gives someone a roof over their head.
Yeah, so if you are one of those lucky people who own a house that has either a side access with a big backyard, or it has enough room down the side to put a granny flat, so do you reckon you would get change out of $150,000 these days for a granny flat?
Depends on the size. Like, there's some big monsters being built. Like, I don't think you need anything too outrageous. And you can see all types of versions of this now, like containers being built and small, tiny homes being built. I think if you factored in $150,000, I think you're pretty safe unless you wanted a Taj Mahal.
Okay, so I've just crunched some numbers. If you had a granny flat and you're getting $350 a week rent, is that reasonable for a little?
Yeah.
So it could be brand new. $350 a week rent would be great for a young professional, first time out of home, to live in a granny flat, right? It's quite secure. It's the back of someone's property. If that person who built the granny flat spent $150,000, that is a 12% return on that money.
Better than the banks?
Yeah. Like, 12% a year, low risk, shut up, take my money, give me the granny flat.
Yeah. And a lot of our strategies with our buyer's agent service has been exactly that. We might not put a granny flat on it for the next 5 years, but the client in 8 years or 10 years, when they've got some equity and they've done their investing elsewhere, can wheel back around and put it in.
Yeah. So even if it cost $180,000 to build, that's a 10% return.
Yeah, it's pretty good. But I think it is the future for homeowners, to be honest. And in an ideal world, they'd love not to have to do it and just manage the mortgage on their own. But because of the repayments and the property prices, it just gives them a little kicker that says, yeah, I can still go on a holiday year or something like that. But the whole, mum and dad can live out the back, or, it just gives you a lot of flexibility as well.
Yeah, no, it's a lot going on there. Before we finish up, anything else happening today, John? What's new with you?
Running a webinar tonight with the great Jess Spendlove, actually.
Right.
Health and Wealth.
Yeah, so Jess, I mean, it's useless to everyone because it's tonight and they won't hear it by the time this goes up, but Jess used to host our podcast called My Millennial Health.
Yes.
I handed it over to her. She's rebranded it to Stay at the Top. And I actually just texted yesterday and asked her if she wanted to come on and talk about 5 or 6 really healthy, low-cost recipes, because she is a dietitian. And so we're going to record that soon. But yeah. And do you know, for those who might be coming out to our events, so basically, if you did register for one of the face-to-face workshops, we asked you a couple of questions like, what's your stage? Are you a first home buyer? Are you a first investment buyer? Are you buying your 18th property? Are you saving for your, whatever the situation is? And I haven't talked to John about this, but are you potentially...
What? This happens every time, mate.
Yeah, that's all right. Are you thinking that you'll potentially, once we send you the data a couple of days before each event, potentially cater the presentation for each room? Like, you just won't do a rinse and repeat Perth Adelaide. Like, we will make it different for each who's ever in the room. Yeah.
And those that have been to our shows in the past, I don't have death by PowerPoint. It's just simply, right, what do we want to talk about? Let's thrash it out. That's the way we like to roll anyway. So, yeah, if I've got some data that says, yeah, we need to cover this, 100%.
Yeah, awesome. We'll do that. All right, everyone. Thanks so much for listening today. Remember, if you're over 50 or you're interested in sending a podcast to your rentals or your uncles and aunts or grandparents, the podcast Retire Right is now back. It's weekly and it's going to be a banger of a podcast. I think John did a podcast episode with Martin. Have you?
I did.
Yeah, yes. About buying property after age 50. Because it's not impossible or impossible, is it?
No. Well, we talked about the risks, why you would do it, why you wouldn't do it, when you wouldn't do it, all those sort of things.
And the type of property as well.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, look, Retire Right, it's a banging podcast. Also, while I've got you all, Jess Brady's podcast, Financially Fierce, we produce that here. That is also now live as at you hearing this. So that's just an alternative if you want to listen to, you know, Jess, she's a financial advisor. She's smashing it. She's got a very different perspective and take on a lot of things than me. So we've just done that. Just if you don't want to listen to me anymore, you can listen to Jess at Financially Fierce and share it with your friends. And yeah, that's a really good podcast. I've actually been heavily involved in the producing that podcast. So I've been to every recording. It's just her talking about topics, answering different questions and having a lot of fun. So I've personally been enjoying producing that in the background. Okay, friends, thanks for listening today. My name's Glenn James. Your name is?
John Pidgeon.
And this is Money.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. If you are interested in furthering your education around money, your career or property, we have 3 books that might help. Check out Sort Your Money Out, Sort Your Career Out and Sort Your Property Out. Find these wherever good books are sold or via the link in the podcast show notes. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination, and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Simo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorized representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. These shoes were made for adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with purchase.